keeping democracy alive with Bert Cohen.
Check for pulse.
Stand clear. Push to shock.
So, yes, there's a huge gap between public opinion and public policy. That people don't feel that they can do very much.
You know what this is? This is a very Hamiltonian system. Alexander Hamilton being the guy here in a very un-Jeffersonian.
In the case of the Republicans, it's dramatically the opposite. But even in the case of the Democrats.
An absolute typhoon of terror against African Americans in the South.
America's fascists are those people who think that Wall Street comes first and the American people come second.
Really seen as a financial sector that's gotten out of hand.
The shooting, the violence, that is not the drug problem. That is, in fact, the drug policy problem.
I speak tonight for the dignity of man.
The dream of freedom, the dream of being able to communicate directly. I had such high hopes for the internet over the many, many years. I remember I was actually at a conference back in 1969 at the University of Massachusetts where whoever was speaking had this vision of something that was kind of like the internet, that where we'd have some freedom, we wouldn't be restricted to just a few channels, all kinds of different political, cultural points of view could be out there, and we could all have equal access, and we'd be free from the monolithic ABC, NBC, CBS, and that was it. And that's not exactly how it turned out, unfortunately. Openness has been thought by many to free us from the choices limited to the corporate few and to open up new worlds of great diversity of opinion and information. Amazingly, it seems that the opposite has happened. In her new book, The People's Platform, Taking Back Power and Culture in the Digital Age, our guest today is Astra Taylor. She writes that this new information age, quote, has been accompanied by increasing consolidation and centralization, a process aided by embrace of openness as a guiding ideal. What? How did we get here? Our guest, Astra Taylor, is a writer, documentary filmmaker, and activist. Her films include, I hope I pronounced this right, Zizek, a feature documentary about the world's most outrageous philosopher, which has broadcast on the Sundance Channel. Taylor's writing has appeared in The Nation, London Review of Books, N+1, and is co-editor of Occupy, Scenes from Occupied America. Well, Astra Taylor, thanks for being with us. There's a lot to talk about. As you write, it wasn't supposed to be this way. You and I suspect, are both proponents of increased democracy. And my guess is that, like many of us on the left, I certainly of the left, we both were enthused by our hopes that, as you write, the digital transformation has been hailed as the great cultural leveler, putting the tools of creation and dissemination in everyone's hands, unquote. The internet has been successful in that, or has it not?
Well, it's been both. And I think that there are a few reasons I wanted to write this book. And one is that I wanted a more nuanced picture because a lot of the popular volumes on technology fall into one of two camps. Either the internet is amazing and it's going to bring about world peace or make us smarter, right, make us better, make us more connected to people across the globe, or it's going to destroy everything and we're distracted and we're addicted to our phones and we don't know how to read anymore. So there's this very polarized utopian or dystopian discourse that I wanted to break into. The other thing is I wanted a left-wing critique. So like you, I am of the left, and I felt that at the heart of progressive politics is a concern for democracy, as mm-hmm. you say, and also an intuition that you have to follow the money. So, as you said in my when you were introducing me, I've been involved in Occupy. So even though I don't talk about Occupy in the book, you could say that this is an attempt to think through the need for an internet that's for the 99%.
Well put.
And there's been a lot of hype about the internet as a democratizing force, but what do we mean by democracy? What does that term mean, and how is it used by interests that actually aren't necessarily benevolent? So I think you know, it's true that we can log on and we can click and we can be in charge of our own media destinies and nobody can tell us what to watch. It's different than the old days of just CBS and a few other channels where everybody was watching I Love Lucy. Nonetheless, the more personalized our experiences are online and through our devices, the more connected we are to a handful of digital Goliaths. And so there's some paradoxes that we need to understand, that even as we have more choice as consumers, we're more and more connected to these giant centralized corporations that are very dependent on the advertising dollar, and ultimately we're not their customers, you know, we're their products.
Yes.
And I think we have to get our minds around the way that the world is changing, because it's not, all is not lost. You know, the technology is neither good nor bad, but it's really the context in which it's developed and the interests who are at the helm.
So then it sounds like meet the new boss, same as the old boss in a way.
It's a little bit like that. I mean, that's one thing I wanted to do, was to show the way that some of the old hierarchies have continued into the online world. And you know, that's not to say that there hasn't been major change. I mean, the infrastructure of the Internet is unique, and it is a many-to-many broadcasting system, as opposed to the old, you know, one-to-many system of television, where, you know, somebody's programming it and all you can do is sit and watch it. Nonetheless, there are aspects of the old order that have carried over, and so there's this word disruption, and there's another word, disintermediation, and these are two terms that people in the tech world like to throw around. The idea is that we're going to disrupt the old media giants, and that disintermediation means that we won't have to go through the old systems anymore. You know, you won't need a newspaper editor to get your news. You could just get it directly from someone who's on the scene. You won't need a label if you're an artist. You can just find your audience directly. And one thing I highlight in the book is the way that this disruption, this disintermediation, has been very uneven. So on the one hand, sure, investigative journalism might be suffering because newsrooms have shrunk by 30% because of the exodus of advertising dollars away from traditional publishers. So we have less people at the state capitol. That's disruption. But advertising has strengthened because now we have advertising in areas of our life that were previously untouched, and because the online space is less regulated. So, you know, in the old television model, advertising to children, to give one example, was controlled.
Yeah.
There's still too much of it, in my opinion.
No, yes.
But, you know, it could only happen a few minutes every hour. But now there are, you know, games online that kids can play 24 hours a day, and kids can friend and like products. So we're in this new space where certain interests have been weakened, some have been strengthened, and we need to look at the way this disruption has been uneven, and to see who's ultimately gaining more power from it. It's true that we can now post to social media and we can communicate more efficiently with our friends,
mm-hmm.
but ultimately, the people who are sort of collecting and aggregating all the data from all of us are benefiting disproportionately from these changes. You know,
yeah,
the government who can now surveil us, potential employers who can look at our profiles on social media, or perhaps even pay data brokers and get information that's been collected surreptitiously that we're not even fully aware of, the way that we're profiled and ranked and stuff. So there are these real contradictions right now, that even as we're more, we feel more empowered and that we have more freedom of choice, power and wealth are actually shifting to a handful of giant corporations that are, I think, just going to become more and more influential.
We are talking on The Burt Cohen Show with Astrid Taylor, author of the brand new book, The People's Platform, Taking Back Power and Culture in the Digital Age. And I was reminded recently on another show, we were talking about the McCutcheon decision of the Supreme Court, and before that, Citizens United, and how there are some who say that money equals speech. Well, as the guest pointed out, money doesn't equal speech. It equals a bigger bullhorn, drowning out everybody else. And one thing I find interesting with TV and with magazines, the point of advertisers, and that's how they make the money, is to grab people's attention. Mm-hmm. And TV, radio, you turn it off sometimes. But nowadays, don't I sound like the old man that I guess I am, people, kids especially, are like always looking at a screen. They're always there. Therefore, the opportunities to advertise are much, much bigger. But when there's not advertising, when kids are using Facebook or Instagram or whatever the heck it is these days, how does that help advertisers and the big corporate interests? And what way do they make out from that?
Yeah, I mean, I think one thing I tried to do is shift the conversation a little bit away from looking from pointing the finger at people who are addicted to their devices or on their screens all the time, and look at the way actually these devices are engineered to be addictive. There's actually addiction by design as a phrase. Hmm. And, you know, we tend to sort of blame the kids in the sense of, look at them, they're constantly playing their Angry Birds or whatever. And I'm more incensed at the adults who are paid good money to create apps and games that kids, can't help but use. These games are designed to be compulsive, right? So I point the fingers at the grown-ups who are in these industries.
Sure.
and not the kids using the toys that they make. But advertising is interesting because I think people tend to go, oh, it doesn't matter. You know, there are those irrelevant ads on the side of my Facebook feed. Who really cares about that? It's not like the old days where if I wanted to watch a show, I had to sit through these annoying advertisements. But in fact, it's much more insidious because it's not so much just what the video ads or the little sidebar ads that we encounter when we're online. It's the way that data about us is collected, because everything we do, everything we click on, leaves a trace. And increasingly, it's not just going to be our computers and our phones. More and more objects around us are going to have IP addresses and also be connected and networked, and they will be leaking data about us. So we see that Google is moving into the home. It bought a company called Nest, so it'll be in your thermostat, and it'll be perhaps in your driverless car. There's more and more an integration between the sort of away from keyboard world and the online world, and this creates massive opportunities for brokers to collect data and try to analyze it. So, you know, there was a piece in the New York Times recently about our license plates being scanned as we go in and out of parking lots, and someone said, well, this will allow us to target people and give them discounts at certain stores that we know they like. Shopping centers sometimes collect the data beaming from our cell phones as we move through the racks. So it's not even just about looking at the screen. It's much more pervasive than that.
And
what this data ultimately does is it's sorted. We're sorted supposedly anonymously, but that's very debatable, into these categories. And so, you know, some of them are quite humorous, even if they're socially troubling. So flailing fogies is one set from a data broker company. You know, old people who are struggling, or, you know, young, savvy people who like, rap music or whatever. We're sorted into these categories, and we are treated differently as a consequence. And so there's potential for things like price discrimination, where there's already evidence of that, or people getting, lenders and creditors giving people different interest rates based on their profiles that these marketers and brokers have compiled. So as we are tracked by marketers, we are also sorted. And then that opens up potential for discrimination. So it's not just that we'll go online and want to buy, something, and these advertisers will be able to offer us exactly what we want, which is, how they justify what they're doing. They're just saying, we're making things more efficient. We're giving you more choice. We're able to better serve you. But there's also ample evidence that it's going to become an avenue of discrimination. And in that sense, it sets back, decades of progress in terms of consumer protection laws. And so there's deeper implications. It's not just oh, I see an ad every now and then and I can ignore it. It's really about the way that we are being, our every move is being tracked and we're being put into these categories.
Hmm.
And what they can infer from the data. So for an academic article just came out the other day that, you know, these marketers can infer from women's Twitter feeds whether they might suffer postpartum depression. On the one hand, you could see that having positive public health benefits, but on the other, you could have, you could see them advertising to these women and offering them pharmaceuticals that might help them. But perhaps seeing those ads would also reinforce the sense that they are depressed. I mean, there are all sorts of new issues that I think are very intriguing.
Wow, there certainly are, and you know, back there was the concept of Big Brother watching us, and it's far more complex and perhaps even insidious now because it's just everywhere. There are the RFDs, I believe they're called, that they implant little chips in items of clothing and things you buy, and they can track those things. They, I guess, would be the manufacturers, the corporations, those who want to get our attention and use us as products, as you say, products. Getting our information, and then how do they use us as products?
Well, a very simple thing to keep in mind about the digital economy is that actually we're not the customers. So it's not as though I pay Facebook
right.
to use the service.
Right.
And so one thing I spend a lot of time looking at is this idea of free, and that term should be in quotes because we like our free email, our free apps, our free social networking sites. But of course, as the cliche goes, there's no such thing as a free lunch. So who's really paying for all of this? And the paying customers are, in fact, the advertisers. And we, as the users, are what's being sold to them, access to us, access to the massive amounts of data that a company like Facebook collects. I mean, Google recently changed its terms of service and reserved the right to scan our emails so that it could better serve advertisers. So I think it's very important to look at this concept of free and to think about the way that free culture, the free technologies, might have costs that really outweigh the benefits. And I look at this dilemma from different angles. I mean, one angle is the material environmental aspect. So we get a free cell phone when we sign up for
right.
a new service plan. Because, the whole point is the Internet is thought of as this immaterial, weightless space. But, of course, it actually is, as the old joke goes, it actually is a series of tubes. It actually is wires. It actually is something that's material. And, of course, we use it through these devices that are made from rare minerals that are mined in conflict zones. So we get a free phone and we're encouraged to upgrade it every 6 months or a year because they're made to break. But there are these environmental and social costs because they're very environmentally destructive and they're the labor that goes into creating these devices is hardly enlightened.
Yeah, it's not exactly
model
benign.
It's the same with all of the news around the Foxconn factories, which are Apple's factories in China, where workers have done their best to protest and some have committed suicide. So there are these costs to the supposedly free devices. And there are also costs, I say, to supposedly free culture and free online services. And really, those costs are the advertising ones that we've been talking about.
Yeah, free culture.
Because in the end, we as users pay multiple times over, even when something is supposedly free. Advertising is there are varying statistics, but at least $500 billion a year economy, and that's money that ultimately we're paying because it's baked into the price of the goods and services we then buy. So it's not free. We're actually, forking this money over because advertising budgets are factored into the cost of things. So one thing I'd really like people to take away from this is to rethink that model and to actually see how inefficient it is, that we pay in this very opaque unaccountable way. It's advertising as a sort of private tax, that we have refused to innovate. Even with all this new technology, all these new devices, all this new opportunity, we're still stuck in this totally retrograde model.
Yeah, you're right.
Not everyone in the world is as committed to as we are.
Well, that's true. And Astra Taylor, you write that, and it sounds like what you're saying, you write that it's imperative that we, quote, rethink how power operates in the post-broadcast era. What do you mean by that? Rethink how power operates in the post-broadcast era.
Right. I think we're caught up in this simplistic model of the authority telling us what to do, what to watch. So it harkens back to the idea of, you know, what life was like when there was just, you know, television and radio.
Right.
Somebody was programming those and all you could do was tune in. And
right.
Now we are able to choose what we want to watch and consume online, or at least it feels that way. I think, again, we have to understand that there's something more paradoxical happening, that even though we can visit different sites, there are still these powerful corporate interests. I mean, Google and Apple are some of the biggest companies on earth. I mean, they're in
yes.
the top five, and increasingly they're lobbying. I think Google last year was in the top five
big corporations
for
yeah.
lobbying in D.C. as well. And so they have certain interests that they're trying to advance, you know, and one is to make sure that they're not restrained in any way from collecting data on us in any way that would impinge their business model. And they have other agendas as well. These tech firms have gotten together and advocated for certain types of immigration reform that would benefit them in their quest to have engineers from other countries. But the point is that they have wealth and power, despite the fact that we are able to engage with their services in a way that doesn't feel as though we're just being controlled by them.
Yeah.
And I think this, I think there are echoes of a broader condition, especially for young people who are coming of age now, where, you know, you might not have a stable job. With benefits and where you're going to spend your entire life, where you're going to have a 40-year career and maybe you'll join the union and you'll negotiate with the boss. People are now freelancing. They're very precarious. They're beginning their adult lives with massive amounts of student debt. And there's a kind of sense that there's a destabilization. There are less institutions are less prevalent in young people's lives, but they're nonetheless in an age of mounting economic inequality and uncertainty. So I think this idea that we have to rethink power, I think, applies in other realms too.
Yes.
There's things are very ambiguous. They're networked. And yet there's still these broader trends of little people getting the shaft.
Yeah, it does seem to be the case. And you talk a bit in the book, The People's Platform, Taking Back Power and Culture in the Digital Age, about recording artists. And, for a long, long time, recording artists have been terribly frustrated by big record labels squashing their creativity and not allowing for the little guy. You know, they just obviously want to make money and have the big acts and have the next big thing. So they're now free agent artists. Do they, as free agent artists, being able to, put their content on the internet, do they have a better chance to have success because of the internet, as they hope?
Complicated. I mean, I would say yes. I wouldn't go back in time. I think this is really important for me to say, is that I certainly love and depend on the internet. In fact, I was just redesigning my webpage with my filmmaking partner before I got on the phone with you. But I think it's important to ask questions. So, one can imagine, and it was the case, that when television was developed, the people were very optimistic. that there would be this amazing medium for education and for awareness in everyone's home, and people could learn. But then, you know, by the time I was a kid, it was like the television, just completely banal. You you were critical of it. I think that that's sort of how it's going to be for younger musicians. Yeah, they will have and maybe a healthier skepticism about these technologies, because they'll take them for granted. So on the one hand, they'll use these tools to promote their ideas or their art or their music or to communicate or whatever, but they'll also be able to see the shortcomings. And in regards to artists, I mean, I think it is miraculous that we can put our stuff out there. And I, you know, I'm speaking here as a filmmaker and a writer. And make contact so quickly with people who are interested in what we're doing. But there's there are risks with associated with just falling back on this model of individual creators.
Yeah, it's tough to make money
going through mediators like a Google and Facebook and Twitter.
Well, that's one thing I wonder about, is that you don't have the limitations of you know, either the big networks or the record labels, and that, you know, through the internet, many artists, musicians feel more powerful with their creative expressions. But there's something you talk about, the gatekeepers. They're more obscure, less visible. But what about the power of these invisible gatekeepers?
Yeah, exactly. And that's it. So you can, you know, and that their power is manifests in different ways. So one way is that you might, and I've actually heard this from callers on other radio shows, is that they've invested a lot of time into, for example, their Facebook page or something like that. And they've built this audience, and they've kind of followed the advice of these tech gurus. But then what happens is that Facebook goes public. It's suddenly under a lot of pressure from its shareholders to figure out additional revenue streams, and so they start making it more difficult to reach your quote-unquote friends on Facebook without paying to promote your updates. So people, and I've heard complaints from artists, I've heard complaints from community organizers, that they're reaching fewer and fewer people on these networks. And the point is that these companies, you know, are not responsible to us. They can change their business models. They can cut services. That aren't as profitable as they need them to be. So you can invest a lot onto these platforms and then have it suddenly taken away from you. We've seen that with things like Google Reader getting shut down, or you know, Google Scholar has kind of gotten demoted and is harder to find. So these companies aren't public stewards who are there to make sure that you can reach the people you want to reach, right? So you might, there's a kind of bait and switch there. The other thing is that the gatekeepers are increasingly dependent on algorithms that are opaque. And they're opaque for lots of reasons. People don't want them to be gamed. But that means that, you know, it's not just this world where we're unmediated and we're kind of up by our bootstraps going out into the marketplace, and the best ideas will inevitably rise to the top. I mean, the problem online is that algorithms often privilege whatever is current, whatever is now, and whatever is already popular. So there's something that's called the bandwagon effect, where basically, you know, whatever's on the top of that most emailed list or the most liked list or has the most whatever stars or hearts or whatever it is, ultimately gets more and more of them. The rich get richer because whatever's popular just spreads more and gets more popular. So, you know, it's not a meritocracy. The idea that this would be a space of meritocracy has failed, and there are ways of kind of leaping ahead. You know, just like the offline world, the more money you have, the more you can buy access to. The more you can buy access, the more access you get. So you know, there are you can pay to be on the front page of Amazon.com. There are lots of ways that there are lots of obstacles in the way of small independent creators. And I think there's a kind of psychologically kind of hard, because, you know, people will tell you, well, you know, you just need to get yourself out there, make something good, and you'll find your audience online. But there's lots of barriers and lots of people who are gaming the system and buying access and making the playing field even more uneven.
Mm, yeah, as you write, instead of leveling the field between small and large, the open internet, and open is such a nice word, the open internet has dramatically tilted it in favor of the most massive player. And these are emerging info monopolies. I don't think people thought about that with the hopefulness of the open internet.
Yeah, I think it's very important. I mean, one thing I look at is the way that we don't really have language to describe the kind of media landscape we want, in part because all of the terminology that we use to describe the digital world is imported from Silicon Valley. And so it has these sort of business interests implicit. These business interests are implicit in the terminology we use. Or a lot of them are just mealy-mouthed. You know, it's not clear what it really means. What does
it sounds benign.
Yeah, so open doesn't mean equal. It's kind of like the free market. It sounds great, but
right.
That leads to the dominance of a bunch of, big, powerful corporations who then try to squelch anyone else.
Right.
So open doesn't mean equal. There are these giant info monopolies, they're bigger than we think. Something like Amazon, for example, you know, it's not just that it controls the book market. And increasingly, retail market online.
Yes.
But it also runs these cloud servers. So, you know, the federal government is dependent on Amazon's internet infrastructure.
Oh my.
And a lot of smaller websites like Netflix and Pinterest, you know, also depend on Amazon. So, I mean, these things are ubiquitous in a way that we're actually really unaware of as regular internet users. But the rich get richer phenomenon also applies to culture. So, you know, going back to your idea of small-time musicians or filmmakers or whatever, we have this thing where there are lots of little guys. There are lots of little people with their websites getting their stuff out there, and that's great. I cheer those people on. But what's happened is the superstars have gotten even bigger. So we have global superstars, and you see this in terms of celebrities, and you also see this in terms of even news sites or other cultural forums, like, you know, the big guys like the New York Times are more dominant. It's more of an oligarchy of the old media because they are now global brands that can reach around the world. And what happens is the middle is missing. The middle is suffering. So on the one hand, it's a consumer's paradise because it's great. I can now read The Guardian, which is a newspaper I really like.
Yes.
And I can read the New York Times. I can get this global perspective. But in my own backyard, there might not be anyone covering City Hall because the local paper is gone.
Because there's no less profit in that. And
yep.
You cite in your book, the People's Platform, the authors of The New Digital Age, and that they wrote, quote, "The internet is the largest experiment in anarchy in history. It's the world's largest ungoverned space." Well, that kind of makes me think about these right-wing libertarians making so much noise and having so much power in the Republican Party these days. Right-wing libertarianism would destroy the commons, and the notion of the common good just is inconsistent with right-wing libertarianism. Is this kind of what's happening in the brave new digital world? What does the tech community mean by their definition of freedom? Is you know, this openness and this freedom? And, you know, libertarians basically hand power to the big Koch brothers and big corporations like that. Is there a parallel?
Such a good question, and I think it's something we could do a whole hour discussing. I mean, the quote that you just read is from two fellows. Eric Schmidt is one of them, and he is, of course, was a former CEO of Google and is still on the board and very active. The guy, I believe his name is Jared Cohen, and he works in the State Department. So you've got these guys, you know, one from the most powerful corporation on Earth, practically, another guy working in the government talking about how the Internet's an experiment in anarchy, and it's just not true. We've seen this with the NSA revelations and government surveillance, and we see this with, these giant corporations that mediate our engagement online. This is, I have no idea what definition of anarchy they're using, but it doesn't make much sense to me. And what it does is it obscures the interests that are actually dominant online. But it does feed into the sort of libertarian rhetoric that you're highlighting that is very popular in the tech community. And, you know, I wanted to challenge the framework that exists, where it's sort of always the big bad state being
the bad guys, but the
being challenged or triumphed by corporations, which is kind of the libertarian model.
Mm-hmm.
And to point out the way that so much of what these companies do is actually dependent on the government. So, you know, the government actually subsidized the building of the internet itself.
Mm-hmm.
This government investment that created the touchscreen, the microchip even probably would not have evolved as it did if it wasn't for the government. So there are these amazing state subsidies, but what happens is the public doesn't get any credit for these investments, and instead they're appropriated by private interests who take the bulk of the profits. And we end up having a very romantic but actually inaccurate portrait of you know, how innovation works, how progress happens, and it feeds into this libertarian mindset. There's so many paradoxes there, and there's this, I think, this naive idea that the internet is a space that, you know, shouldn't be regulated and the government shouldn't be involved. But the point is that, you know, the government is involved, and there are so many public subsidies, but they're not benefiting us, the people who are actually providing them. So at the end of the book, I try to imagine what would happen if we took all of these public subsidies and actually put them into service of democracy instead of private profit.
What a concept. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
And I think it was the 1920s when the Federal Communications Commission was created. And the point was that there was the public spectrum was limited, and that the broadcasters mm-hmm. were required to serve the public interest in return for using the public spectrum. Now there are fewer, if any, limitations on the public spectrum, and it was based on scarcity,
yeah.
But now we see great abundance. Do we need some sort of updated version of the FCC, and are they up to the task?
Well, the FCC sadly isn't up to the task because, like so much of Washington, they're stuck in this revolving door madness where the current head of the FCC was actually a former telecom cable lobbyist. But I absolutely agree. I absolutely think that there is a need, and I think that we shouldn't get confused by the scarcity argument. So, as you say, the idea was that we needed public broadcasting back in the day because there were only a few channels. Bandwidth was limited, and now bandwidth is theoretically unlimited.
Mm-hmm.
So people say, well, what does it matter if Comcast and Time Warner control your access to the internet? You know, you can go onto any little website you want. Or what does it matter if, you know, Amazon dominates the publishing industry because you can buy lots of different books from them? And I think we have to work on our arguments to counter that, and to think about the role that the productive role public media could play. And one thing I find really fascinating is the way that these companies and these services invoke public service and these public models. So Flickr has been compared to a land trust. Flickr is a photo sharing service. They compared it to a sort of land trust as though they were stewards of public land. Google is often compared to a library or an archive. Twitter and Facebook are compared to town squares all the time. So there's this sense that we need public spaces. We need commons.
Yes.
And yet, ultimately, these are not commons at all. They're privately run companies that serve their shareholders over their users. So I think there's a desire for public media, but we're afraid to take the plunge and really advocate for it. And as I, again, to go back to the earlier question, the irony is that we actually are already paying. The public is paying. The public is already subsidizing. So I think we need to connect those dots. Because what we will find is that I think the public aspect of these services and what has made them so charming will be eroded over time. And we see that in Facebook and Twitter, you know, asking us to pay to promote our tweets and our updates more and more. We see that as mm-hmm. unprofitable aspects of the services are quietly done away with in favor of revenue streams that are more immediately rewarding. I think we're going to see the public aspects being repealed, and what we should do is work on how to bolster them, but make them a true commons, not these fake commons.
Fake commons, indeed. I mean, the idea of the commons being owned and controlled by a few corporate interests, Google, Amazon, whatever, picture are the founders of this country. That's not what they had in mind by the commons. I mean, you know, having monopolies control everything. We've had monopolies throughout our history, and they've been rolled back and taken on. And yet, you know, here in 2014, Americans, a lot of Americans are deeply skeptical of any kind of government involvement in the culture and the arts and technology. But as you say, the computer industry and the internet would not even exist without this massive funding from we the people through our government. Now, since life as we know it basically now depends on the internet, how important is it that the pipes through which all this digital content flows be controlled perhaps as a public utility? What's going on with regard to that? Is there any movement toward recognizing it as a public utility, like water and electricity?
That is absolutely crucial. That is foundational, because you know, what are we talking about when we talk about the internet? It can be a lot of things. It could be the video you just watched, or it could be the message you just sent, or it could be a game you just played. But you know, on a sort of lower foundational level, it is the infrastructure. It is the pipes. It is the on-ramps to the internet. And there are really good arguments that this should be regulated as public utility, just the way the phone companies of yore were. In countries where they have stronger public obligations on internet service providers, consumers get better service, cheaper service, and more freedom and choice. And so there's this sense that what we have in the United States is sort of the worst of both worlds, and that we have we don't have a very you know, righteously engaged government regulating these things. We don't have a public option, but then we also have no competition. The market is failing us as well, because a lot of us only have, you know, one cable company,
right,
maybe two if we're lucky to choose from.
Total monopoly.
I think there is a growing awareness. I mean, there on the one hand, as you say, there's this real, you know, strong skepticism towards government involvement, but mm-hmm. there's a recent Reuters poll that showed that the majority of Americans are also very worried about the way these tech companies are encroaching on their lives. So I think we are at an interesting turning point where there's skepticism of these corporations as well, and I think that's what needs to be harnessed by advocacy groups, and some are already trying to do that.
Like which?
But the thing is that, you know, and how skeptical are we? I mean, we can say people might sort of be taken aback by the idea of internet infrastructure as a public good, or there being a public option, but, you know, people send their kids to public schools every day, so how skeptical can they be of the government being involved in things that are absolutely crucial? Seems like a public school is would be more controversial than public internet infrastructure. I think we're often very contradictory on these things, you know.
Well, there are people on the right who really want to, they call it government schools, and they want to destroy public
education. Yeah, but they're a fringe, you know, that's a pretty
small
group. The vast majority of Americans, you know, do benefit from government services all the time. And I think we can be pretty, our suspicions can be sort of misplaced. When it comes to media, people are very, you know, skeptical of the idea of state involvement. They immediately think of, you know, communist Russia or something, and people's speech being suppressed. But many independent third-party sort of groups, nonprofits and stuff, that look at things like economic freedom and how democratic a country is. The Economist magazine has something called the Democracy Index, have shown that the countries that have the most government investment and involvement in the media and have state subsidies for journalism or have internet providers regulated as common carriers are more democratic. They rank higher on these lists than the United States, which is just falling year after year in terms of freedom of the press and stuff like that. So, you know, a lot of our fears are misplaced.
Of course. And fear, of course, we don't understand things and, you know, we're busy. So, you know, some people just trust the big corporations. They don't want to have the government involved in it. I wonder if this, well, one of the things that some people have made some changes about, and left and right, and people in the middle, just in terms of other utilities, in terms of water and electricity, there have been some changes for municipalities to take them over from private water and private electric interests. You know, we all depend on these things. Is there any sense that municipalization may be part of the answer, or is that too challenging?
No, that is actually an idea that's really gaining traction, and there are a few cities that are held up as the sort of paragon of that. And Chattanooga, Tennessee is one where they have municipal broadband. It's incredibly fast. It's attracted a lot of growth. It's also one of the few communities that's actually investing in libraries, and so there's this sense that, you know, it's not just the internet or the old world, but maybe all of these public services can go together and complement each other. And the cities have done that, have gotten really good press. But one thing that's really important to be aware of is the way that the cable companies have been mounting not even defensive, but offense against these municipal efforts. They've spent hundreds of thousands of dollars in a single town to block communities or block states from providing public options. So these special interests that have very deep pockets, because they essentially have monopolies. I mean, you know, I might be misremembering this, but I believe that Comcast profits are something like 95%. I mean, because they have once they've got the wires, they just leak money, you know. So they've got very deep pockets. They're in a very profitable business, and they're using those profits to block communities from creating alternatives. So the municipal option is a really good one, but it's one that has to be fought for, because the cable companies really don't like that idea. But where it has happened, you know, there've been great successes, and citizens have been really pleased. So you're absolutely right that's an option that needs to be on the table.
No, like municipalization, I'm reminded of Teddy Roosevelt trust busters back, you know, when there was monopolies over 100 years ago, and here we are doing it again. And
exactly, and this is the thing. It's, you know, there's so much of the rhetoric of a brave new world, and that this is, you know, there's been a revolution and a break with the past has really misled us, because what we're seeing is, you know, struggles that aren't that different from struggles that have been waged before, even if they were, you know, different industries, even if it was, you know, the old oil companies mm-hmm. monopolies that had to be broken up, or the telegraph monopolies, or whatever it was in the past. But those, we should be learning from history and not pretending that it's irrelevant, because this technology changes everything.
And Albert Einstein said the unleashed power of the atom is changed everything save our modes from thinking. Well, it's time for our modes of thinking to do something about it. Very interesting book, and I think really vanguard of a change that needs to be done. I don't know if there are any organizations that are that Astra Taylor, you've been aware of, that are, you know, at the head of starting trying to democratize the internet?
Yeah, there are some wonderful public advocates out there. I would recommend everybody look at the Free Press, which has been doing a lot of good stuff around net neutrality and advocating for public media. It was actually co-founded by Robert McChesney, who's been writing about media issues for a long time and obviously was an influence on me. But I think you're right. I think we are at a turning point, and we will see more and more campaigns. Another good one is Demand Progress. People who are connecting the dots and pushing back. So I actually think this is a really exciting time.
Yeah, it is. Our book is The People's Platform, Taking Back Power and Culture in the Digital Age, Metropolitan Books. Astra Taylor, thank you very much. Very fascinating and provocative inspiration. And it's just barely beginning. And there is.
Hey, thank you. Thanks for all the thoughtful questions. I really appreciate them.
Well, thank you so much. Astra Taylor, thanks so much for being on the Burt Cohen Show. And we won't get fooled again.